Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you at the Collège de France for this symposium on information processing biological system. So we're going to have a very rich menu of different people contributing to this interesting question. So information, I will just say two things about information. It is really regarded by biologists as a very vague, by biologists as a very boring concept because it's all about DNA and genomes and that we know. You know, what else should we say about information besides what we already know? So why make it a subject of a symposium or teaching like I've done at the college? And many physicists would say, well, it's a very vague concept. What do you actually mean by information? And how is it going to be useful as a way to predict and biological problems? So I defend a view which is that information is neither vague nor uninteresting, but rather fundamental. There are definitely important aspects that need to be better defined at a conceptual, technical level. And this is why we have this symposium, to be inspired by people coming from various places who will help us thinking through this problem of information. And so we'll have people who come from biology, from physics, on different subjects, whether mechanics or other kinds of information that is important in biology. And so I will invite you to basically not hesitate to ask questions so that, because we'll have time. Each of the speakers will roughly have 30 minutes to present their work, followed by 10 minutes of discussion. And so please don't hesitate to ask questions so that we can have a thorough discussion through from what they will present. So without any further ado, I would like to say that, so there will be a coffee break, which will be outside the room. I'll show you the way after we finish the first half of this morning session. And I will invite now the first speaker of this morning, Steve Quake. So Steve Quake is coming to us from California. He's a professor at Stanford University and is also the head of science at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. So thank you very much, Steve, to come. I would like to emphasize also that Steve Quake is an invited professor at the Collège de France, and he's already given a lecture last Monday. He will give a second one on the 26th of May, and then he'll come back in September. This has been advertised, but for you who want to know more about what he's doing, please come to his lectures. Okay, thank you very much. Steve, please. Pointer, were you given a pointer?
This is here, yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Thomas. All right. It's wonderful to be here. This is going to be a recapitulation of my lecture from Monday, a little more technical in detail. And just to show that Thomas and I were thinking along the same lines, last year, Cell commissioned an essay for me about, there's an anniversary of the central dogma, the 65th, something like that, and they wanted an essay around the central dogma. And I went back and read Crick's paper, and you know, it's all explicitly about information flow in protein synthesis. How does information get processed and transmitted in the question of protein synthesis? And so rather than kind of look backwards at that, I decided to look forward about, instead of the central dogma, I said the cellular dogma, tongue in cheek, and tried to, you know, argue very generally, raise questions about information flow in the cell and what I thought were outstanding problems. The piece has more questions than answers in it. And in general, three main questions about types of information flow, all of which I hope to touch on today, and I think the other speakers will be touching on some of these as well through the course of the day. And in one sense, how does the genome encode the information that becomes the organism in a very general sense? You know, one example of that that's been sort of great interest to me is how do you predict the cell types of the genome, from the genome? If you're given a new genome, can you predict the cell types of the organism? That's an open problem. Has not been solved theoretically or computationally, although in principle it seems like the information should be there. I'll talk today about ways that we've gone about that experimentally. Another type of information, how do cells communicate and change state and identity during development? And how do relationships between cell types encode information from evolutionary timescales? All of those fascinate me, and we'll find ways to touch on them in the next half hour. So let's start with this question of, you know, the genome, which Thomas disparaged a little bit in the introduction, and I think rightfully so. It is at some level certainly been oversold what you get from sequencing the genome. People talk about it as the blueprint of the organism, but there's not really a sense for any multicellular organism in which we understand it as a blueprint. And I think that's probably the wrong metaphor, because every cell in your body, more or less, has the same genome, and yet those cells take on very different identities and phenotypes. And so maybe the way to think about the genome is more of a parts list, and different cell types can pick and choose among those parts in order to assume their identity. Sidney Brenner realized this 20-odd years ago, and in his Nobel lecture, he called this out as a real limitation of our knowledge of the genome, that we don't know how it's used to make different cell types. He proposed a big project to work this out phenotypically, which he called CellMap. In his incredibly visionary way, he said, well, if we work at it really hard, it'll take about 20 years to get it done. And we sort of are there now, 20 years later, to have at least a rough draft of what he proposed as the cell map. How do we go about making these measurements? Well, it's all sort of crucially dependent on the technologies that have been developed to measure transcriptomes from single cells. And I'm not going to really do a deep dive in it on the technology beyond this slide here, but the basic way the measurements go are you take a tissue, you dissociate it to single cells by enzymatically digesting it, and then you use a technology that will allow you to isolate the single cells, amplify the cDNA, and barcode them so each cell has a unique barcode. And there's multiple ways to do that, most of them using microfluidics, and that's been a part of my research for many years. But once you have that, you have then a test tube with many cells worth of information in it, each one barcoded, and you can sequence it using next generation sequencing, and then that gives you the opportunity to compute on it. So each cell gets represented by a 20,000 dimensional vector. In the human genome, there's roughly 20,000 genes, and so for each cell you have the number of each component of that vector is the number of mRNA molecules from that gene that were expressed in that cell. And so that's a 20,000 dimensional space. And there's just a lot of rich information there. And I'll talk quite a bit about how we analyze that in the back end of the talk. You've probably seen pictures like this in lectures in recent years. Just to put it in context, each dot in one of these diagrams is a single cell. And as I mentioned, it's embedded in a 20,000 dimensional space. It's been projected down to a two-dimensional space through dimensional reduction. In ways that will preserve some of the distance relationships in a higher dimensional space. And they're often color-coded by clustering relationships in a higher dimensional space to give you a sense of structure in the data. And this is a sort of powerful tool for visualization. So it took about 30 years to work out the ways to do this. And it started with the ability to do amplification from single-cell transcriptomes. And that was back, in the 1990, almost as soon as PCR was invented, the first biochemical amplifier, people began thinking about how to amplify transcriptomes. And then progressively more pieces of the puzzle were solved, where now this is incredibly straightforward and easy to do, and pretty much any lab can do it through commercial available tools. And as that was happening, my group and other groups in the community have been working on sort of particular questions. We realized there's an opportunity to do a large-scale project here to build a cell atlas that's a phenotypic companion to the genome for any organism. And that's, in fact, why we set up the San Francisco BioHub, was to do this at scale and build whole organism cell atlases. We really specialized in trying to do this in such a way that we took all the tissues from the same animal or donor and went through anywhere from 18 to 24 tissues to really build a comprehensive characterization of the cell types. And we did this for mouse, we did it for fly, we did it for lemur, and we did it for human. And these have been incredibly powerful tools, not just because of the data that was generated, but we put a lot of effort into annotating all the cells. And these were large team science projects. There were maybe 150, 160 authors on each paper. So in addition to generating the data, our teams of tissue experts went through and annotated every cell, and these became the sort of largest human expert annotated data sets in the field that became great benchmarking tools for people developing computational approaches to analyzing this data. So I'm going to tell you today about Tabula Sapiens, which is our human cell atlas, and some of the as yet unpublished pieces of it, and how we're thinking about it. So this is Bob Jones, who's a senior research engineer, quarterbacked the whole project in my lab, and it's really because of his efforts that we managed to get this done. This now, each row is a different tissue, each column is a different human donor, and size of each circle represents the number of cells from that donor. And to the left of the dotted line is what we published a few years ago. To the right is what's up on the bioarchive now, which essentially doubled the size of the data set from 500,000 to 1,000,000 cells. And as I mentioned, we made a huge effort to try to get multiple tissues from the same donor in order to keep the genetic background constant, as well as other factors such as age, epigenetic effects, environmental exposure, and so forth. And we got to be quite good at that. Getting nearly 24 tissues from a single donor. And we were able to do that thanks to a really amazing collaboration with an outfit called Donor Network West. They're a nonprofit organ procurement organization that serves Northern California and Nevada, and they're the ones that help provide organs to people in need of transplant. Once the transplantable tissues are used from a donor, if the proper consents are there, the remaining tissues can be used for research purposes. And so we engaged with them on this, and it was sort of by far the most complex research project they'd ever done, and they were just terrific partners to help us make this happen. It is very challenging to get so many tissues from a single donor. It typically is 24 to 36 hours of consecutive work, so all-nighter. It typically starts in the evening. The surgeons are at work taking out the tissues one by one. They go into the sort of ice buckets and are shipped to the various labs who process them, and then everything comes together at the biohub for the final kind of sequencing. And just requires enormous amount of dedication from the team. It's a really sort of unique project. And you can see this is like some ungodly hour in the morning, a couple folks taking a rest in the hallway. And we did a lot of this during COVID time, actually. And you see the folks with masks, and added another layer of complexity to the coordination of the whole thing. I obviously can't go through all the names, but I want to just reemphasize that this was just an awesome collaboration between, something like more than a dozen labs at Stanford, UCSF, Berkeley, as well as the BioHub, and incredibly dedicated students, postdocs, and staff. So let me tell you a bit about how we look at the data and tell a couple stories about it. One has to do with transcription factors, and these are obviously incredibly key to how cell identity and cell state, cell type is specified. There are 1,622 transcription factors, putative transcription factors in the human genome, many of which have only been identified as predicted transcription factors and are not characterized biochemically at all. We decided to go through that entire list and see which of them were expressed somewhere in our data set. And it turns out all but two are expressed in the data set. So we now can say for essentially every human transcription factor in which cell type they're expressed and where to go look at their biology and what they're doing. And as we kind of assembled this data, we decided to try to characterize them by their sort of cell type specificity. So we used this statistic tau, which was developed to look at gene expression specificity in bulk data some years ago, but applied it to cell types here, where when tau is near one, that means it's unique to a single cell type, and the smaller it gets, the more broadly and ubiquitously the transcription factor is expressed. So we sorted them all by tau, and this is sort of what they look like. So these are the high tau transcription factors. These are the low tau ones, a subset of both, and then the extremes. Each column is a different transcription factor. The row is the gene expression level across different cell types. And you can see that for many transcription factors, they're expressed in only one or a handful of cell types. They have a very high degree of specificity. And in many cases, for well-studied cell types, we go back and we look at the transcription factors that are expressed there, and they all make sense from what we've known biologically in the literature. And for many other cell types and transcription factors, this really identifies for the first time where they're expressed and what their role is in human biology. So that's terrific. Here are the low tau ones. You can see in contrast to these, they're expressed ubiquitously. These are the 162 lowest tau. If you focus on those, here they are sorted in ascending tau order here. So this is the same group I just showed you there, and then there's more this way. If you look at the ones that are there, it's many well-studied transcription factors that are known to be central to the function of every cell type, no matter what they are. Things related to stress response, proliferation, cell division, metabolism, those sorts of things that every cell has to do and more or less does the same way. However, we also discovered in that list a number of transcription factors that were as yet uncharacterized. And so if you look at the ones that say ZNF and then have a number, these are all predicted zinc finger transcription factors, most of which have never been studied. Nobody knows their role. And so it's just amazing to me that there are elements of cell control universal to every cell that have not been discovered yet, despite how many decades of the molecular biology revolution. And so again, these are very interesting ones to start zeroing in on and understanding their role. I'll tell you one more bit about this, and this now concerns the question of cell states and how cells change their state through the course of an organism's lifetime. So senescence is an idea that was first put forth by a fellow named Leonard Hayflick. He discovered that cells are not immortal, and they can have only a finite number of cell divisions, around 50 cell divisions. This is called the Hayflick limit. It's taught in the textbooks. And if you do the math around that, about the number of cell divisions you can have and cells in the human body, that puts an upper limit on human lifespan, a theoretical upper limit of about 120 years. he passed away. Hayflick passed away last year. And someone at the New York Times had a lot of fun writing the headline, "Leonard Hayflick, who discovered why no one lives forever, dies himself at 96. And so when the cells stop dividing, they move into a state that he called senescence. And it's been a subject of much study, the aging field has really invested an enormous amount of time and effort in understanding what's the nature of senescence. And what we decided to do was look for senescent cells in our data set. And for the sort of experts in the audience, they're defined by cells that are P16, also known as CDKN2A positive, and are MKI67 negative. So are not dividing, and this is signal of senescence. And realize that we have probably the largest data set ever assembled of human senescent cells in one place, from actual living humans, not from cell culture. And Madhav Mantri, a postdoc in my lab, decided to go through and look at all these. And they occur at around the 3-4% level, which is what one would expect. We see them in every tissue. And Madhav decided to go look to see if there was a common gene expression program shared by all senescent cells. Do they have the same differentially expressed genes? And they don't. So there's differences. There's no single gene expression program for senescence. And you can look at the differentially expressed genes and how many cell types they appear in. The only one that appears in all of them is the tautologically one that defines the cell type or the cell state, CDKN2A. Even CDKN2B is not found in all of them. And as you go down the list, you can see any given gene is expressed in smaller numbers of cell types. So it's not correct to think about there just being one type of senescence. There's actually many different kinds, but all is not lost. It's not that every cell type has a different, unique form of senescence. By doing non-negative matrix factorization and thinking about groups of genes being expressed, there's roughly 16 programs of clusters of genes that seem to be senescent programs that are combined in different ways across 6 broad classes of senescent cells. And so, the broad classes cross different tissues and represent shared cell types like epithelial, endothelial, stromal, and different immune cells. And you can see that here they are clustered by their differentially expressed genes, but in ways that show that it's not tissue specific and crosses across. Here it's colored by tissue. And you can see that in each cluster, different tissues are contributing cell types. So there are some commonalities, but it's something where there is an interesting degree of nuance. So for the remainder of the talk, I want to talk how we're using large language models to understand this data. We have, as a field, I think collectively assembled quite a bit of data, something like 100 million cells worth of data have been pulled together onto CZI's database called Cell by Gene, which anybody can access. And there's a question of how do you think about all that data together? When genomes were being sequenced, people began to assemble the genomes and assemble the jigsaw puzzle, so all the different reads and libraries were put together into one assembly. It's not clear how you'd assemble all the cell type data together. And so what Yuri Leskovich and I decided to do a little while ago was try to build a large language model and find an embedding space that would sort of summarize all this data and provide a way to think about all of it in context and in relation to each other. And so we did that. And there's a couple things I want to just say about it. One is the model was trained in sort of the usual way, where it's a big neural network, 650 million parameters, which seems like a lot to a physicist. I mean, it sort of makes you vomit when you think about overfitting. But is it really overfitting? Because it's 36 million cells and 20,000 numbers per cell. So in fact, the number of parameters is much less than the number of data points. And in trying to find the weights of the model, what you do is you mask roughly 20% of the genes of any given cell and then try to predict their expression. And then you iterate the parameters until you've done the best possible predictions you can. The other thing about this model that is very clever, and I won't take credit for it because it was Yuri's idea, was to do it in such a way that is not dependent on any given genome. And so we used ESM2, which is a protein language model, to put every gene from every organism into a common embedding space. And so we could train the model on data from many different types of organisms and then use the model on organisms that it hasn't even been trained with. Through the fact of using this protein embedding space that is independent of the genome. So we trained the model on something like 8 species. It's primarily human. You can see color by species here. The blue is human. The orange is mouse. And the other colors are lemur, zebrafish, pig, a couple other non-human primates, and frog. And two very talented students were the ones who actually carried the water on this, Yusuf Rouhani and Yanni Rosen. And as I mentioned, it was about 36 million cells, 300 data sets from collective efforts around the world, and about 50 different tissues. So how do we check that the embedding space that came out of this is something that's reasonable? Well, a number of different ways. One was to use held out data that the model was not trained on. So the Taubia sapiens 2 data, which I just described to you, was not published and was not shared in the training of this model. So we then took it and embedded it in the space afterwards. So the model had never seen this data. And it embedded it. The orange is Taubia sapiens 2. The blue is Taubia sapiens 1, right where it's supposed to go. Every cell type went to the corresponding cell type from previous donors, and it all lined up very well. So the model had learned something about, you know, where human cell types sit in this embedding space, and given data it had never seen before, it puts them in the right spot. That was reassuring. The other thing we did was put in data from a species it had never seen before. In this case, it was a data set on green monkey that another group had taken on the lymph node, put that in the embedding space, and asked which cell types from the training set were closest to that. And so you can predict a cell type name based on where the cells were sitting, compare that to how the authors had annotated the cell types. And it did a reasonable job of getting those annotations right, saying that, you know, the model helps you analyze data from species you've never seen before and has learned something fundamental about the biology. Speaking of which, we could say that the, you know, as we started to ask this question in more generality, and we began using the embedding space as a metric for calculating phylogenetic distances between cell types, you get things that look like this. So this is now phylogeny calculated on a transcriptome using the embedding space. And what we see is that cells of similar types are closer together. T cells, all very close together in the space, closer to other immune cells such as B cells, whereas muscle cells and endothelial cells are sitting together in other places. And so the model has learned these relationships very well, even though it was never trained on any biology. The only thing it was trained on, remember, was a matrix of numbers. just those gene expression values by cells. It wasn't told the names of the genes, wasn't told the annotations of the cell types, wasn't told any biology. This is just, it's learned the relationships between the 20,000 dimensional vectors. And in the more general sense, if you then look at the cell ontology tree and look at things like father-daughter relationship, parent-child relationships between cell types or sibling relationships, you get a histogram of distances within the embedding space. And then as you look at cousins and more distant relationships, you can see the histogram is shifting and the distances are moving further away. So again, it's learned something about our human knowledge of cell ontology purely from those numbers. We recently, CZI built a second generation model, which we're calling Transcriptformer. That went up on BioArchive a couple weeks ago. And in this one, we are a little more systematic in how we trained it across evolutionary time. And it was led by Theo Karaletsos. Again, you know, sort of a little bit of bias in number of cells by organism, but also by cell type. So if you look at cells per cell type, it's reasonably even across a pretty large range of evolutionary time. And in particular, Theo and his team went and trained multiple different models with different sets of training organisms. So from the bottom up, okay, one model, which he calls Transcriptformer sapiens, is trained only on human data, 57 million cells. Another one called Transcriptformer exemplar, is trained only on model organisms. So human, mouse, zebrafish, fly, and worm. And the third model, which is called Transcriptformer metazoa, is trained on something like 100 million cells from 12 different species. And so human, mouse, chicken, frog, invertebrates, also a couple of single-celled animals, fungus and malaria. So this one sort of spans a huge evolutionary distance. And then Theo and the team began to evaluate how the model does on various performances, one being cell type classification, and compared it to other large language models out there in the literature, including UCE, which was the first generation one I described. And you can see that the various transcriptomer models and UCE do a pretty good job on cell type classification. It's pretty saturated. Other models are, you know, almost as good for the most part, but not quite as good, still pretty saturated. And when you dig in and ask, you know, where does it work well, where does it not do well, most cell types, all the models, so these are the cell types, these are the models, the colors, the performance, most of the models doing very well across all cell types. The ones where you start to see differentiation is this group down here, which if you zoom in, it's right here, T cells are the toughest to classify. And Transcriptformer does better on those than the other models. Very interesting that this is the hardest one to understand, and we're still trying to figure out why that's the case. Again, when you look at performance on held out data, Transcriptformer does very well and essentially best in class. In this case, this was a data set of human lung infected with COVID, and the model was asked to try to differentiate COVID-infected cells from those that were not COVID-infected, and did a very good job of that. And then finally, if you ask how well do the models work classifying across evolutionary time, it looks sort of like this. So this is performance. These are the organisms. They're organized by evolutionary distance. And you can see that for all the models, the performance decreases the further back you go in evolutionary time. The one that's best performing are metazoa, which is not surprising because that was trained on the broadest evolutionary range. But almost as good, essentially, you know, with an error, is the model organism, exemplar model. And so we're trying to figure that out, that in fact, you know, training on more organisms doesn't help beyond a certain point. You know, why that's the case, we don't know, but it's got us scratching our heads, and we're thinking about that now as sort of a super interesting observation that's come out of this. So, do I have like 5 more minutes? Yeah? Okay. So, let me share a last, now totally unpublished story about evolution and cell types. Convergent evolution is one of the great mysteries in biology. How do complex structures like the eye arise? That's a classic example. Even Darwin thought about that one. And you can go back to Origin of Species, and he's writing about his hypothesis that it came from two different primitive cell types, a photoreceptor and a pigment. Others have suggested many different structures of eyes across the tree of life, and folks have suggested that these have evolved independently many times. The classic example of that, I'll talk about in a minute, is the box camera eye. But others, like Gehring, have argued that, in fact, the eye structures are all governed by a single master regulator, and in fly, there's a very beautiful example of that. So these are sort of the two divergent viewpoints. Box camera eye is a classic example. Humans have it, octopus has it, but there's no common ancestor between the two that has it. There's this great question of, did evolution find the same solution twice, and if so, how did it do it? Flies, of course, have something totally different, compound eye. So we decided to build a cell atlas of the octopus and went and did, we wanted to do eye, that was the major interest, but since we were working with the octopus anyways, we also did brain and tentacle, and using the techniques I've described, have gone and put together that data set. And I'll just say we've annotated them all, and we've also got good human data from not just Tabula Sapiens, but other published data, have been able to do sort of human annotation of these cell types based on differential gene expression, and have a pretty good idea of what's what. And then the question is, how do you compare them? So this is work we did before the large language models, and in fact have used an algorithm developed by Bo Wang, who's a very creative faculty member at Stanford, in bioengineering, who was thinking about how to map evolutionary relations between cell types, developed a very nice algorithm called SAMMAP, which would allow you to both have ways that connect gene homology between species in their genomes, but also then between cell types in their transcriptomes, and sort of iterate between the two and find some way to optimize the balance between homology connections and transcriptome connections. And that is a very interesting way to do this. We found a very high degree of correspondence between cell types. This is octopus, this is human, these are the various cell types. And by doing SAMMAP, you can see that, wow, there's an amazing degree of connection. Like, how could it be that they not only evolved the same structure, but the same cell types as well across all? That seems very highly unlikely, right? And so that was a bit of a clue. But then we thought, all right, we should do the outgroup comparison. Let's compare to a non-box camera eye, like fly. That's this right here. We had the fly atlas, right? So here is, I think it's octopus in the middle and fly on one side and human on the other, if I remember correctly. Oh no, this is octopus, human, and that's fly right there. And turns out all the cell types map just as well on the fly. And in fact, there's no difference. And so if you map there's a parameter you can sweep, which is an alignment threshold, and ask how well do the cell types map between octopus and fly and octopus and human, and it's basically indistinguishable. So that was sort of interesting, and sort of the conclusion we're drawing from that provisionally is that, it's no matter what the structure of the eye is, the cell types used to make it are ancestral. Okay, and the Lego blocks are shared in deep evolutionary history, and they're just used different ways to build these different structures. And yet, and even though the structures can be quite different in their morphology, there's a deep underlying sort of shared molecular program of cell type that's used to make them. Okay, and with that, maybe I'll stop and take questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-2-France.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.